You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 17th of December 2012 on Monocle 24. Midori House is brought to you in association with Moncler. Hello and welcome to Midori House here on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Tom Burgess-Watson. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, grieving with Newtown. President Obama addresses a community in shock following the shootings of 20 children and 6 adults at an elementary school. Observers call the president's words a departure from any speech he's ever delivered before. And 2 years on from the spark that began the Arab Spring, we take you to Tunisia to ask, what's the state of the nation today?
I think it's time for us to create a democracy that fits our culture and our past, so we will take our time. It's bloody sometimes, tense, happy, euphoric, but I think that in some years, some democracies in the Arab world are about to be born.
We also head to the icy poles of the north, where ambassadors and statesmen and women come together for the Arctic Council. We'll hear what was discussed and by who. Plus, one of Monocle's more sartorially minded gentlemen, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, speaks to Valerie Steele from the Fashion Institute of Technology in New York about a rather special new book.
When I trace the history of collecting and exhibiting fashion and then even creating fashion museums, it was amazing to me both that the idea went back so far to the 18th century to how hard it was to actually start real specialized fashion museums.
So we've got all of that and lots more besides during the course of the next hour here on Midori House. So a very warm welcome to you. But before all of that, let's get a wrap of the world news. That's with Bill Bingham.
Monocle 24 News. Schools in two Connecticut towns have been closed after sightings of a suspicious person who police believe may be armed. One of the towns, Ridgefield, is about 20 miles from Newtown, the scene of last Friday's massacre at Sandy Hook Elementary School, where a gunman shot dead 20 children and 6 adults. The schools in nearby Reading have also been closed as a precaution. The first funerals are now being held for victims of last Friday's shootings. State Police Lieutenant J. Paul Vance says they're hoping 2 survivors will be able to help them reconstruct the movements of the 20-year-old gunman who carried out the Newtown attack.
There are 2 adults that were injured in the facility in the school that suffered gunshot wounds and are recovering. Our investigators will, in fact, speak with them when it's medically appropriate, and certainly they will shed a great deal of light on the facts and circumstances of this tragic investigation that we're undertaking. They're holding that school as a crime scene indefinitely, and I can't even tell you what that means. I don't know how long that'll be. I'm suspecting months.
The funeral of a nurse who apparently killed herself following a royal hoax call to a hospital in London has taken place in her Indian hometown. 46-year-old Jacinta Saldana was buried at a church in Shirva, just outside Mangalore on the southwest Indian coast. Members of her family were joined by hundreds of mourners. The nurse had taken a prank call about the Duchess of Cambridge, who was being treated for acute morning sickness. An explosion in eastern Afghanistan has killed 10 girls who were out collecting firewood. The girls, aged between 9 and 11, were collecting wood in a remote area near the border with Pakistan. 2 others were injured in the blast. And at least 17 people have been killed and more than 40 hurt after a car bombing in a crowded market in Pakistan. Officials say the device went off next to the women's waiting area of a bus stop in Jamrud town in the troubled northwest tribal region near the Afghan border. South African police say they've foiled a plot by suspected right-wing extremists to bomb a meeting of the ruling African National Congress. 4 men aged between 40 and 50 have been arrested. Police say they'd planned to plant a bomb in one of the tents. Almost 5,000 ANC members, including President Jacob Zuma, government ministers and top business people, are attending the conference in the central city of Bloemfontein. These Zuma supporters are confident their man will win a second term.
I'm fully behind second term. Sholos Yangena.
Very fair, very nice, exactly what you expect.
I'm very happy about the nomination process, and we're very sure that second term.
We are leading one not.
Second term, we're winning.
Syria's Vice President Farouk al-Sharaa is saying neither the government's forces nor the rebels can win the 21-month-old conflict in his country. He's told a Lebanese newspaper the situation is getting worse because neither side can bring about an end to the violence. He says an historic settlement is needed. Shinzo Abe says his party must move forward and achieve results following its landslide election victory in Japan. The conservative Liberal Democratic Party won almost 300 seats and could end up with a two-thirds majority in the lower house with its coalition partner. The governing Democratic Party suffered big losses in Sunday's polls, with party leader Yoshihiko Noda stepping down. China has urged the new government to take practical steps to deal with the East China Sea territorial dispute. And that's the latest news from Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, Bill. 1805 at Greenwich Mean Time. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24.
Vanuit Londen. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
Uit London, dit is Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, dette Londres.
Og London.
London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House, live from Studio One in London. Now, as we go to air, the first funerals have been starting for the victims of Friday's shootings at the Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut. Shootings which claimed the lives of 20 children and 6 adults. Well, on Sunday, President Obama gave what was his fourth speech as president to a community torn apart by a mass shooting incident. But many who listened to the president's speech agreed that this was a departure from any speech delivered by Barack Obama to date. Well, here's an extract from that speech.
In the coming weeks, I'll use whatever power this office holds to engage my fellow citizens, from law enforcement to mental health professionals to parents and educators, in an effort aimed at preventing more tragedies like this. Because what choice do we have? We can't accept events like this as routine. Can we say that we're truly doing enough to give all the children of this country the chance they deserve to live out their lives in happiness and with purpose? I've been reflecting on this the last few days, and if we're honest with ourselves, the answer is no. We're not doing enough, and we will have to change. We can't tolerate this anymore. These tragedies must end, and to end them, we must change.
The US President Barack Obama speaking there. Well, to explore how important such speeches are in a time of crisis and national introspection, we're joined now by Sasha Eisenberg, who's our DC correspondent and also the author of Lend Me Your Ears, All You Need to Know About Public Speaking. We're also joined by the speechwriter for the former British politician Lord Ashdown, Max Atkinson. Thank you very much indeed to both of you for joining us. Let me begin with you, Sasha, in Washington. How has that speech been received, not just in Newtown, but across the United States?
No, it got pretty good notices last night as the president was giving it and this morning. You know, there's a small undercurrent of criticism from folks mostly on the right who say that he politicized the killing by talking even in a sort of vague, indirect way about sort of the need for some sort of action or regulation, but broadly, it was well received, and even among folks who've been sort of traditional pro-gun advocates in the media and in Congress, there's a sense that something changed in the mood after the shooting on Friday, and that Obama did a decent job of giving voice to it at a difficult moment.
And Sasha, follow up on that. Does it sound to you as though Obama has declared war on the all-powerful gun lobby there in the U.S.?
And that might be going a little too far. I mean, you know, there have been moments like this before, perhaps never so directly. I mean, the clip that you played had a more sort of assertive call to action. The president even sort of laid out a timeline for tackling this in a way that he didn't after, as he mentioned in the speech. This is the fourth time he's given a speech after a sort of major gun massacre. There was an implication in that speech that this is going to be taken a little more taken on a little more directly than in the past. Still, there's you know, a lot of work to do, and it's a pretty busy period in Washington, and the gun lobby still has a whole lot of structural influence over certainly parts of the Republican Party and a lot of Democrats from sort of conservative rural states.
Sasha, I'm going to come back to you in just a moment. Let's turn now to Max Atkinson, the former speechwriter of Lord Ashdown. Thank you very much for speaking to us. That was an incredibly difficult speech for the president to deliver. There were sobbing adults and children audible there as he spoke, and he named each child, clearly very moved, but remaining composed. Do you think Obama struck the right tone?
Yes, is the short answer, but he always does. I mean, he's just absolutely brilliant at finding the right tone and coining words which are memorable. I mean, I noticed that some commentators were referring to it as his Gettysburg Address. I mean, I may be a little bit strong. I don't think you can assess it that quickly. But it's interesting that sort of comment is being made about it.
Do you think, as an observer from this side of the Atlantic, do you think the tone would have been appropriate if that was, say, a European or a British politician or prime minister addressing a shooting or a similar tragedy on European soil?
No, I don't really, because I think that an American president is able to, how can I put it, trade on religion much more closely than it's possible for example, a British Prime Minister to do. So that although he doesn't say an awful lot about religion, there's quite a lot of it, especially in the second half, towards the end of the speech, where he does talk a lot about what our obligations are to children and all that sort of thing. And I think that American politicians are much more able to, as it were, do God than is the case with British politicians.
Indeed, it did open on a very religious wicket. And rather amazingly, President Obama, even in a speech like that, a 17 or 18-minute speech, which it was, very, very somber tone and tragic circumstances, he even managed to weave some humour into that speech as well, which I was impressed by, because that's getting into rather risky territory. I don't know if you remember the comment he made about the child who said, "Don't worry, I know karate, we'll all be safe." And he managed to get a laugh at what was essentially an extremely sad speech. Did you find all of that appropriate?
Well, I mean, again, it just shows his mastery, because all the best funeral orations you ever hear have quite a lot of laughter in them. The great funerals speeches have quite a few laughs in them, and it's not an easy thing to do, but he did it very effectively. Talking about some little boy who's an expert on karate and he's going to lead everybody out and deal with this terrible intruder.
Sasha, let me come back to you for a moment, because the fact that President Obama isn't going to run for office again, do you think that was a factor that perhaps made this topic and this issue of gun control rather easier for him as a second-term president to take on than it might otherwise have been?
I think that's right. I mean, one thing that's really notable about Obama's career as an African-American politician who came out of one of the most liberal state Senate districts in a city that at the moment has the highest gun crime rates of a major city in the U.S., is how much Barack Obama has avoided any sort of talk or certainly action around the issue of guns in the decade that he's been involved in national politics as a candidate for the Senate, as a candidate for president. Everybody, I think, expected that you had a black liberal from Chicago, and he would end up being a gun control advocate. And in fact, I think in many respects, it comes out of his experience dealing with downstate rural Democrats in the Illinois legislature who come from areas where gun ownership is widespread and hunting is popular. And I think he understands the sort of perilous cultural politics. And I think that a lot of that sort of red America, blue America bridging has sort of been manifest in Obama's traditional reticence to make guns one of his sort of targets. And he's talked about it not at all in the campaign this year, other than that one moment in a debate where they were asked, and he didn't seem that eager to make it much of an issue. And so I have to believe that something like this had happened earlier in 2012. You might have had some of the same sort of desire to be a comforting figure and talk about the tragedy, but not necessarily the same call to immediate action.
And briefly, Sasha, if healthcare could be described as having defined Obama's first term, do you think there's an expectation or perhaps a hope that gun control will be very much the defining factor of his second term?
I think it's probably way too quick to come to that conclusion. There's certainly liberals who feel that this might be the thing that precipitates that more than anything else in decades. But, you know, Obama's sent signals that he wants to get a deal on immigration reform, and that's another big sort of cultural, social issue in this country, and there's probably only so much room to take on one of those at a time.
Max Atkinson, let me give you the final word. Going towards the language of President Obama's speech on Sunday, he used lots of strong words, unacceptable, intolerable. He said, enough is enough, we must change. Does that sound like somebody who is absolutely not going to let this go? Is he going to deliver on all of those promises?
I'm somewhat skeptical about whether he will because of the power of the so-called National Rifle Association. It's a bizarre thing, listening to these speeches about these disasters from this side of the Atlantic, that rifle shooting is one thing. I mean, shooting deer and pheasants needs one kind of gun. It does not need these kind of automatic multi-loading guns that seem to be permitted. And there seems to be a huge confusion between the concept of what a rifle is and what an attack gun is. And the American laws seem to make no difference whatsoever between them. I'm not advocating that everybody should have a rifle, but I do think that it's pretty... he's hiding to nothing in a situation where there are such strong lobbies in favour of guns in general. And all guns. I mean, it's the guns which seem to be involved in this and other disasters that we've had are the kinds of guns which nobody in their right mind who's wanting to shoot deer or a few rabbits would want to use.
Thank you very much indeed. You had the last word, Max Atkinson. Thank you also to Sasha Eisenberg in DC. We'll be back in just a moment to find out what's changed in Tunisia 2 years since the Arab Spring began.
During snowy December, Midori House is brought to you by Montclair. And from December the 27th to January the 2nd, we'll be heading off piste to broadcast the briefing in Midori House live from St Moritz. Montclair, keeping the slopes stylish and warm since 1952.
On Monocle's Culture Show, we want to be like the fabled Hydra, one of the great monsters of Greek myth, but in a good way. Listen to one fascinating story and two more eagerly pop up to replace it. So it's only scary if you're frightened of the following sorts of things. Reports from all over the world on art, books, magazines, media, music, film, publishing, advertising, and photography. Or if you're terrified of beautifully performed, intimate live music sessions from some of our favourite acts recorded in our performance space right here at Midori House. It's Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. It premieres on Mondays at 1900 London time, and frankly, it's the heroic Hercules that defeats the evil Hydra of radio boredom. Join us and enjoy the legend.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Tom Burgess Watson. 18:18 Greenwich Mean Time, 19:18 in Tunis, which is where we're going to head to now, because 2 years ago, Mohamed Bouazizi, a young fruit and vegetable salesman in southern Tunisia, set himself on fire in protest against government oppression and corruption. His desperate acts brought angry crowds out of the streets across Tunisia and led to the overthrow of the president, Zine El Abidine Ben Ali. Well, 2 years on, Monocle's Naomi Sherbel-Ball has been back to Tunisia, the birthplace of the Arab Spring, to find out how life has changed for ordinary Tunisians.
A few hundred metres from the central mosque in Tunis, hidden away in the winding streets of the Medina, an election is taking place. Ilhem Abdelkefi went to one of the oldest schools in the heart of Tunis and helps run the Old Girls Association that meets several times a week.
Today it's exceptional because we have our General Assembly. It's an election day because we have had already our mandate of 2 years, so it's finishing and we are starting a new one with the elections. Majority of the association which existed had democracy within their functioning, but outside those associations there was no democracy at all.
Under the former president, Ben Ali, there was no democracy. Last year, just months after the Tunisian revolution forced Ben Ali into exile, Ilham Abdelkefi and her friends proudly voted for a new government for the first time.
For many people, it was the first time we went to to vote because we did not believe in voting before. So that was an event, yes, for us. To feel a real citizen doing its own act of civil life and taking part into a political event and feeling that we are doing something for our country.
Many of those who run the association are now teachers and professors themselves. They are waiting for the next generation to take over.
Le tout repose sur deux générations.
Les plus jeunes n'adhèrent pas.
Jamila Benous, a local historian, tells me that the younger generation have been busy with other things. It was the Tunisian youth who drove the revolution, using social media, rap music and graffiti as a means of protest. Amira Shebli is an actress and a dancer in her 20s. When the Arab Spring began, she decided to document what was happening in the streets of Tunisia. Her film, Democracy Year Zero, co-directed by Christophe Cotteret, recently premiered in Tunis. In a cafe just before the film screening, Amira tells me how desperate young people felt in the years before the revolution and why they took to the streets after Mohamed Bouazizi's death.
The two last years under Ben Ali were so tense. People were deeply depressed. My cousin committed suicide. Then when Bouazizi committed suicide, when you just say that people prefer death than living in this country means that people are ready to do whatever to change it. And people were not ready anymore to make any concessions, and we got to that point of no return.
But the euphoria of the revolution, which embraced freedom of speech and democracy, has given way to a harsh reality. In recent months, young people have been taken to the streets once again, and protests have become violent. Unemployment remains high at 17.6% and youth unemployment is still higher. Across Tunisia, cafes are full of educated young men with few prospects. Amira Shebli tells me that Tunisian democracy will take time to build.
It's not easy to go out of a revolutionary context. It's not easy. It's not a matter of 2 years, but I guess it will take like at least 5 to 10 years to settle the first real democracy. With the struggle against the lefties, the Islamists, I think it's time for us to create a democracy that fits our culture and our past, and this is the purpose of it. So we will take our time. It's bloody sometimes, tense, happy, euphoric, but I think that in some years, some democracies in the Arab world are about to be born.
The new Islamist-led Tunisian government, feted around the world as the vanguard for democracy in the Middle East, is facing fierce criticism at home. The revolution promised a new freedom of speech unknown under Ben Ali, but in October, journalists went on strike in protest against government interference.
Because I'm a journalist since I was very young. At the same time, my father was a journalist during the period of occupation.
Soufiane Ben Farhat is editor-in-chief of La Presse, Tunisia's main French-language newspaper. And, he is particularly concerned about attempts by the leading Islamist party, Ennahda, to censor the press.
The first thing we have won after the revolution is freedom of speech. Journalists has changed because before they were not free, and some of them were victims of the repression of the ancient regime. And after, they are continuing commitment for the freedom of press, with sometimes some mistakes because freedom is new for us and is not always respected. The power is the power, even if the power of the revolution, the power has always this tendency to want to domesticate the press.
But the threat to freedom of speech doesn't only come from the government. There is now a small but growing Salafist following in Tunisia, a movement of extremists who seek to impose Sharia law. And Soufiane Ben Farhat has been told that Tunisian extremists linked to Al-Qaeda plan to kill him.
They said they want to kill you and the other journalists because they said in Tunisia they are against us. We are not against no one. I have no party. I have no political color.
In June, a controversial art exhibition in the capital prompted riots across Tunisia, led by ultra-conservative Islamists. And in September, here in the centre of Tunis, the American embassy was attacked by a Salafist mob in reaction to a video mocking the Prophet Muhammad. Tunisia is a fledgling democracy, and its future remains uncertain. The country's new constitution is still a work in progress, and Tunisia remains divided, torn between its secular identity and its Islamic roots. Tanks and armed guards still protect the Kasbah, the centre of government. But here on Avenue Bourguiba, the main street in Tunis, banners campaigning against corruption and torture hang between the trees. Here, the revolution's legacy of freedom of speech still lives on, but Tunisians are beginning to understand just how fragile freedom can be. For Monaco in Tunis, I'm Naomi Sherbel-Ball.
Well, we're going to stay in Tunisia now because covered across the Middle East and the Maghreb, here's a Tunisian classic, Sidi Mansour Yababa by Saber Al-Rubai. Tunisian classic, Sidi Mansour Yababa, that's got our producer jumping up and down in the control room. You're listening to Midori House. Fast approaching 1:30 the hour. Here's a wrap of the world news with Bill Bingham.
Schools in two Connecticut towns have been closed after sightings of a suspicious person who police believe may be armed. One of the towns, Ridgefield, is about 20 miles from Newtown, the scene of last Friday's massacre at Sandy Hook Elementary School, where a gunman shot dead 20 children and 6 adults. The schools in nearby Reading have also been closed as a precaution. The first funerals are now being held for the victims of last Friday's shootings. The funeral of a nurse who apparently killed herself following a royal hoax call to a hospital in London has taken place in her Indian hometown. 46-year-old Jacinta Saldana was buried at a church in Shirwa, just outside Mangalore on the southwest Indian coast. Members of her family were joined by hundreds of mourners. An explosion in eastern Afghanistan has killed 10 girls who were out collecting firewood. The girls, aged between 9 and 11, were collecting wood in a remote area near the border with Pakistan. Two others were injured in the blast. At least 17 people have been killed and more than 40 hurt after a car bombing in a crowded market in Pakistan. Officials say the device went off next to the women's waiting area of a bus stop in Jamrud town in the troubled northwest tribal region near the Afghan border. South African police say they've foiled a plot by suspected right-wing extremists to bomb a meeting of the ruling African National Congress. 4 men, aged between 40 and 50, have been arrested. Police say they'd planned to plant a bomb in one of the tents. Syria's Vice President Farouk al-Sharaa is saying neither the government's forces nor the rebels can win the 21-month-old conflict in his country. He's told a Lebanese newspaper the situation is getting worse because neither side can bring about an end to the violence. He says an historic settlement is needed. Shinzo Abe says his party must move forward and achieve results following its landslide election victory in Japan. The conservative Liberal Democrat Party won almost 300 seats and could end up with a two-thirds majority in the lower house with its coalition partner. China has urged the new government to take practical steps to deal with the East China Sea territorial dispute. And those are the latest headlines here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, Bill. It is 18:31 Greenwich Mean Time. You're listening to Midori House. Now, promoting cooperation, coordination and interaction amongst the Arctic states. That's the remit of the Arctic Council, which is a body made up of the 8 states with territory in the Arctic Circle, namely the US, Canada, Russia and the 5 Nordic nations. Well, since it was established back in 1996, the AC has been meeting on a regular basis. And by all accounts, it appears to be a body that functions pretty well. Well, the latest edition of Alpino, which is Monocle's winter newspaper, has a special feature on their latest gathering in the small town of Haparanda, which is in the north of Sweden. Well, joining us here on Midori House are two people who were at that very meeting in that rather frosty venue. On the line, we're joined from Tromsø in Norway by Gustav Lindt, who is Sweden's ambassador to the Arctic. Thank you very much indeed for joining us there. And I'm also joined here in the studio by our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield. Thank you to you both. Let me begin by asking you, Ambassador Lindt, what are, at this present moment, the hottest topics in the Arctic Circle?
Well, in the Arctic Council, we are working on the Swedish chairmanship, which will end in May next year. And one of our main priority is the protection of the Arctic environment from oil spills. So we're both working on prevention, so it will not happen, but then also negotiating a legal treaty on cooperation in the case of oil spills, so cooperation between different Coast Guard and other authorities that are responsible. So this was one of the main topics of that meeting and one of the main topics of our chairmanship.
And Ambassador Lindt, this is a sign of the times, isn't it? Because this is a region that lots of countries are very keen to get into and get their hands on its resources.
Well, I would say your description gives somewhat of a wrong idea because, of course, this region, it's very well organized and there's a legal framework for it. Well, there are 8 sovereign states and the Law of the Sea Treaty shows rather clearly who controls what in the Arctic. But then, of course, there are many different companies from different parts of the world who are interested in activities in the Arctic. And, of course, they have to follow the national jurisdictions of the different Arctic states. And also from the Arctic Council, we are working with multilateral rules and the multilateral cooperation in order to get this development to be as sustainable as possible.
Let me turn to you, Steve Bloomfield, our foreign editor. You were at this latest meeting in Sweden. Lots of talk of cooperation consensus amongst the members. Did you see that in evidence while you were there observing that meeting?
No, indeed. It's one of those strange things. It's an international organisation that seems to actually work. So you've got the 5 Nordic countries, you've got Canada, you've got the US, and you've got Russia. And any international organisation which has both ambassadors from the US and Russia, where they're quite happy to sit in the same room and talk to each other and seem to get on, is certainly a good thing. And as Gustav says, there are a number of key issues that they have to deal with at the moment, from how to deal with oil spills, how to deal with tourism, all these things. And they're all based on one main factor, and that is climate change. If it wasn't for the changing climate and the changing Arctic, they wouldn't have to deal with a lot of these issues. But because the ice is melting, now you can get ships going through the Northern Sea Route. So that's going north over Russia. 40 ships went through there last year. Now, that's quite small compared to Suez Canal, which sees 20,000 every year. But that number of 40 will keep growing. And it raises big issues about what happens if an oil tanker crashes, which some ambassadors when I was up in Haparanda said is a question of when, not if. So it's really important that they're sat around this table talking about, if these things happen, how do we all come together and use what we've got to try and make sure that it's not an absolute disaster?
Ambassador Lindt, let me return to you. What Steve was just describing there, everyone's worst nightmare of an oil tanker crashing. Is that the sort of thing that keeps you awake at night?
Well, actually, it is high on the agenda of every Arctic Council in the public debate and also on the high agenda in the Arctic Council, as things should be, since it's important for all our different states. So, of course, the problem in the Arctic is that it's such a vast part of the world, and there is a lack of resources, and that's why it's so important for all the Arctic states to cooperate. And I think also that's one of the reasons why the cooperation works so well that we are all very aware of the lack of resources, lack of infrastructure, and how much we need to do in order to make the Arctic Council, I mean the Arctic, a good place for the people living in it and sort of protect the sensitive environment too.
And I think one of the advantages that the Arctic Council has as an organisation is that on the whole, they're dealing with the issues of cooperation. So the things you mentioned at the start, Tom, about you know, who owns which parts of the Arctic, issues over oil and resources, those are being dealt with elsewhere. So there's the UN Convention of the Law of the Sea, where everyone has, I think, another couple of years to make their bids for which parts they believe they own. So particularly Denmark, Canada, Russia, all lay claim to the North Pole. That's been dealt with in a very separate organisation, you know, completely different. So I think that then makes it a lot easier for these guys to get around a table, even in a community centre somewhere in the north of Sweden, and thrash out their differences quite easily.
Now, both of you were at that latest meeting there in northern Sweden. And there were also not just the members of the Arctic Council, but also some observers, amongst them China, Japan, South Korea. Ambassador Lind, do you welcome their participation in your meetings? And do you think they made a valuable contribution?
The Arctic Council is a uniquely open international forum for observers and others. And I think the Arctic Council has benefited through this, because if we have, for example, in a working group with the climate scientists, of course it's important to get in climate scientists from all the different parts of the world. So they have had a very beneficial contribution to our work, I would say.
I think what Ambassador Lind is saying there is quite right, but also I think it just shows you how important geopolitically what's going on in the Arctic is when you've got China, Japan, Korea, and even Britain so keen to be involved when, let's face it, many of them, particularly China, are very, very far from the Arctic.
And very briefly, Steve, you were there at that meeting. You're a bit disappointed by the costumes of some of the people who were attending. You were expecting something different? Or?
Well, I think, as I say in the piece, it's very easy to think of the Arctic Council as being an exciting place and as something with, you know, with northern lights and very sort of Philip Pullman. It's not. They're all just, you know, very, very nice diplomats, but just diplomats in a community centre. And we ate a lot of reindeer.
The poor reindeer. Thank you very much indeed to you both, Gustav Lind and Steve Bloomfield, here in the studio. Thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Midori House.
During snowy December, Midori House is brought to you by Montclair. And from December the 27th to January the 2nd, we'll be heading off piste to broadcast the briefing in Midori House live from St Moritz. Montclair. Keeping the slopes stylish and warm since 1952.
Before you set off on your travels this winter season, don't forget to pick up your issue of Monocle's winter newspaper, Monocle Alpino. We get cold weather combat training from Japan's elite snow patrols. We look at how Iceland has picked itself up and dusted itself off after a nasty wipeout. And we find the comfortable alpine retreats that will have you packing your bags and heading for the hills. Plus, we look at winter warming fashion ideas with all of the trimmings, including Bavarian lederhosen. That's all in the current issue of Monocle Alpino. Prost und zum Wohl!
This is Midori House on Monocle 24, coming to you live from London with me, Tom Burgess-Watson. Now, there's a new arrival on the Chinese art scene. Founded in 1983, the art newspaper covers global events, news and talking points that affect the world of art. Well, the paper already has a bureau in its original home city of Turin, as well as in London, Paris and Athens. And last year, it launched in a new edition in Russia, now China. Joining me here in the studio is Anna Summers-Cox, the founder of the art newspaper. A very warm welcome to you.
Thank you for inviting me.
Tell us about your decision to set up shop in China. What's the thinking?
Well, doesn't everybody want to set up in China? I mean, it's the coming place. And I was talking to Patty Wong, who's the head of Sotheby's Asia, and I said, Patty, can you think who might be a good partner? And Patty's a woman as good as her word, and she sent me two names straight afterwards, and one of those names, sure enough, is our new partner, and it all happened incredibly quickly.
Very reliable indeed is our Patty Wong, very familiar face as well in the UK press. Now, is your new newspaper going to be written in Mandarin, or is it just going to be that you're writing with a team that's based out of there writing in English?
No. It's a concession to the Modern Media Company, and it's going to be written in Mandarin. It's going to be called The Art Newspaper China, though, in English. And they're going to distribute it along with Bloomberg Businessweek China, that they already have the concession for.
And what are the key art cities of China? What would you describe as being the capitals?
Shanghai, Beijing and Guangzhou, I think. I think those are the three really main ones.
That's interesting, because the two that I thought of before speaking to you are Hong Kong and Macau, because back in the day they were where a lot of antiques were traded. But you're saying that neither really counts for much.
I've read old fashioned. I still don't quite think of Hong Kong as being part of the main course. Of course, Hong Kong. And Macau, I think, was think of as a gambling centre. But I dare say, I mean, given that the Chinese also gamble a lot on art, probably art is features there too.
Of course, China is as well a market where there's lots of fakes and there's also been a lot of damage done to China's heritage, arguably. Is this going to be something that you're going to, these topics you're going to broach, or are you going to try to toe a fairly consensual line, at least to begin with?
No, I think I was just saying to my future colleagues, I was saying that, you know, we mustn't just deal with contemporary art and the art market. The heritage is very important. And the question of fakes and also phony auctions, all these things have got to be written about, frankly. And I think the Chinese government is fairly open to that. They're beginning to realise that this is an important topic, not least because, of course, a lot of money's been bound up in it.
But the art newspaper is a publication that doesn't mince its words. You've done investigative journalism, you've done, you do exposés. Do you think that sort of journalism's welcome? Are you a little worried about treading on toes in China?
Well, I personally am not, because I'm not going to get banged up in jail. Our future colleagues, they've got a contract and that binds them to be honest, not corrupt, to be, you know, not to bend towards the market. They've got to judge what is going to stop just short of getting them banged up in jail, because if you get banged up in jail, you can't actually do anything. We will be having every issue translated to us, so we'll know exactly what they're writing.
And just briefly, before we wrap up, tell us a little bit about how your newspaper got started and why Turin is your home base. It's rather an improbable choice.
Well, it wasn't me who started it. It was a man called Umberto Alemandi, and he started Il Giornale dell'Arte because he realised that the art world needed something that gave the background of what was going on in all fields, not just, you know, one thing like old masters or whatever. And I was editing Apollo magazine and realising that nobody much read it, and I saw this Giornale dell'Arte and thought it was absolutely terrific. Asked around till I could meet the man, and then the man said, would I launch the art newspaper? So I did that in 1990. So actually, 1983 is the date of the original one, the Italian one. So we have the Italian one, the English one, also an office in New York, a big office in New York. And there'll be more to come, I think.
So from the great Italian civilization to the great Chinese civilization, very much a sign of the times. Thank you very much indeed, Anna Summers-Cox, the founder of The Art Newspaper. You're listening to Midori House. We'll be back right after this with a look at a newly published Bible of fashion designers. More on that in just a moment.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Лондрис, Нова Йорк, Токио.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. See on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monocle 24 です.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24. 24.
1846 Greenwich Mean Time. You're listening to Midori House here in London. Now, the Fashion Institute of Technology in New York has just released Fashion Designers an A to Z. Well, it's a veritable who's who in the fashion in the world of fashion. 644 pages giving the lowdown on every designer you've ever heard of, plus, I would imagine, a whole lot more. Well, Monocle's Fernanda Augusto Pacheco caught up with the FIT's museum director and curator, Valerie Steele. They started by discussing what you're never supposed to judge a good book by, namely its cover.
Valerie, I have a copy of A Fashion Designer's A to Z with me, and it's a pretty hefty book, I have to say. And it comes
weighs a ton, doesn't it?
Yeah, but it's lovely. I have the Prada one with me with those lovely tiny hearts. Can you tell us about the other five? Because I have the Prada already, but I heard there's other designers that did the same cover, right?
Well, the only ones that I've actually seen in real life are the Prada hearts and the Prada bananas. But we also have Etro and Missoni and Acris and Diane von Furstenberg.
Oh, I'm jealous. Are there Prada bananas as well?
Yeah, there's Prada bananas as well.
Oh, God, fantastic. Where did you come up with the idea of the book? I know you wanted to show the collection of the FIT Museum, correct? But how did you came up with the idea?
That was the idea. I've always wanted to do a book on the collection, and my first idea was to actually call it Fashion Museum. And through good luck, I was approached by one of the editors at Taschen, and I pitched this to her, and she went back to Benedict Taschen and came back and said, oh, yeah, we are really interested in your collection. And then since our collection is heavily 20th and 21st century designers, we decided we'd organize it by designer rather than, you know, going through the history of fashion the way the Kyoto Costume Institute book did, because they have many more 18th and 19th century dresses than we do. So that was how it ended up, and they thought of the A to Z, and we thought, oh, that's perfect. That's how we actually hang our designer clothes in the costume archive. So we have our, you know, Armani, our Balenciaga, our Chanel, our Dior in successive rows. And so I thought, oh, that's terrific. Let's do that.
And it looks wonderful, I have to say. And also, in the introductory essay in the book, you talk about the rise of the fashion museum. And it is very true. People are more interested in fashion, don't you think?
Absolutely. People are fascinated by fashion exhibitions. And so when I trace the history of collecting and exhibiting fashion and then even creating fashion museums, it was amazing to me both that the idea went back so far to the 18th century when it was just imaginary to how hard it was to actually start real specialized fashion museums.
And the first one, there's an interesting quote. The first one apparently was in England, right, in 1712?
No, that's a completely imaginary one, darling. The first one is imaginary. And the second one is temporary in 1900 at the big Paris exhibition. No, that's what's so funny. In the 18th century, there was a hilarious article suggesting that there should be a museum set up of fashion. And you could get some bankrupt old dandy and make him be the keeper of costume because he would be an expert on fashion. And people were supposed to bring in their new fashions they invented. It was a darling idea. It said, you know, they'd have little dolls like mannequins set up, dressed in the fashions of past eras, on shelves, just the way you have books on shelves in a library. And it was the whole museum was supposed to be shaped like a sphinx, which is kind of a fabulous idea, implying that fashion is, you know, mysterious and feminine and dangerous.
Have you ever visited other fashion museums around the world?
Not all, but many of them.
Do you have a favorite besides yours?
Well, the two in Paris, of course, are wonderful. It's interesting. The first one, the Musée de la Mode de la Ville de Paris and the Palais Galliera, people started working on starting that, you know, right at the very beginning of the 20th century, and it took them 70 years before they finally got it open. And then the second one, they started working on it in the 1940s, but it didn't open until the 1990s. So really, people were collecting it, and they knew that there should be a fashion museum. But even in Paris, capital of fashion, it took forever.
And I want to talk a little bit about your exhibitions as well. I mean, you had so many, like China Chic, Belgian Fashion, the latest one with Daphne Guinness. Which one do you feel most proud of?
Well, I think that two in particular stand out for me, Gothic Dark Glamour and Daphne Guinness. I think that Gothic was a real watershed for us because it took a thematic show and used the exhibition design to help tell the story of what Gothic is in fashion. We had amazing McQueens and Galeanos and Rick Owens in there. And I do think that the famous McQueen show at the Met, in a sense, reflected some of our ideas. Because, of course, we were looking at all of McQueen's very gothic shows over the years, his runway shows. And then Daphne, I think it's so important to look at more than just, you know, great designers, to recognize that also they're individuals of tremendous personal style who might be in the fashion industry or not, who also help create fashion.
And I want to ask as well, just, I mean, for our listeners, which exhibition is on at the moment and what about the future ones?
At the moment, we have on Ivy Style, which is about Ivy League fashion. And then in our Fashion History Gallery, we have Fashion and Technology. In February, we're going to start a big takedown Ivy Style and open up a big new show called Shoe Obsession, which will look at all of the extreme and extravagant shoes of the 21st century. I think a lot of people will identify with that. And then in fall of 2013, we're doing a big show on queer style, from the closet to the catwalk, about the role of gay people in the creation of fashion.
And that was our very own Fernando Augusto Pacheco speaking to Valerie Steele about Fashion Designers and A to Z, a book published by Taschen. You're listening to Midori House. We'll be back in just a moment. ...1852 Greenwich Mean Time. Now, every day this week on Midori House, we're welcoming our bureau chiefs from our outposts around the world to help us take stock and mull over the year that was on their patch. Well, today we're lucky enough to be joined here in the studio by our New York maestra, Aisha Spears. Hello. Hello, our maestra.
I'm not going to put that on my business card. That sounds wonderful.
That's quite a grand title, isn't it? I think anyone who'd picked up a newspaper in 2012 would probably say the biggest world story, let alone the biggest American story, what was the election?
Of course. From the beginning of the year, we were flooded with it, with the primaries. You can't forget the theatre of Newt Gingrich, of Michelle Bachmann when she was still there, Rick Santorum, Ron Paul, the crazy things that he said. So yeah, 2012 was very much defined by the election, looking at the GOP primaries and then the actual election of November and the subsequent re-election of President Obama.
I love all those names you mentioned because they mean so much to us in 2012. But next year, you know, there will be people who fall by the wayside and we cease to know who they are anymore. And what a colourful bunch of names as well. And, you know, let's say, what are we now? How many months since the election has it been now?
November 6th. Right, so just over a month.
5 weeks. 5 weeks, exactly.
And we're still spotting that the most amazing thing that you're seeing all over weird news sources online are who can see. It's like, where's Wally with Mitt Romney? So what's he doing now? People get excited that they see him shopping. He's at a boxing match. He'll obviously fall a little bit by the wayside. And now we move into the actual job of presidency.
And are people on the whole satisfied? Or do you think, you know, the end of the campaign and the end of the voting process has resulted in the United States perhaps being a rather divided place?
It is rather divided, and I think the thing that people are probably not satisfied with is the continuing divide and partisanship in Washington, which we're seeing have quite dire consequences at the moment with this very well-termed fiscal cliff that the US is facing before the end of the year. I think that it was interesting seeing how a lot of young people got out the vote, and you could, I think in 2016, we'll see the Republicans really working out how they can capitalize and get their voters out there. The Democrats did a much better job this time around.
We're going to move on from the election in just a moment. But one question I was just putting to Sasha Eisenberg in Washington, our correspondent there, was that how, you know, Obama is now a two-term president. Is he likely to have a stronger platform and to do things a little bit more daringly now that he never needs to run for office again?
One hopes. I think that's what a lot of people hope. And not even if they're Democrats or Republicans, but more in a case of leadership. I think a lot of people felt that Obama didn't fulfill promises that he was going to. So we'll see how that goes, especially with the fiscal cliff negotiations. And another thing, which was a big topic of the year, how he handles gun control after all the shootings that happened.
Absolutely. A very sad year of shootings, in fact, because the one that we've been talking about just at the top of the show, the one in Connecticut in Newtown, was one of a number, wasn't it?
Indeed. So, I mean, the sad thing is in the U.S., you never go a year without some horrible mass shooting. This year was no different. So in July we had the shooting in Aurora in the cinema where 12 people were killed. In August there was a shooting in a Sikh temple in Wisconsin where 7 people were killed. And then over the last 2 weeks we've seen a shooting in a mall in Oregon, and then of course what's happened in Newtown, Connecticut. And that's just a few of them. It is a regular part of the American news cycle, and it's a sad regular part.
Do you find in your daily life, when you're meeting other journalists or engaging with a taxi driver, whoever it may be, they hear your British accent, they hear you're not from these parts. Is the topic of gun control something you ever enters into discussion? And are you ever asked for an opinion from outside?
A little bit. I mean, New York City is a very different place from the rest of the country when it comes to gun control. We've had Mayor Bloomberg, who leads the mayor's coalition against guns. He has been very vocal over the weekend about how he thinks about Obama should respond. New York, people don't really talk about it that much. But we've seen shootings this year, actually, in New York of policemen shooting people in public. So guns have been an issue there. I think that it's very hard for people who aren't American to really understand why people hold on to the Second Amendment right with such, you know, with they really love it and they won't let go of it.
Because surely the founding fathers weren't thinking of automatic weapons and hypermarkets, if you like, selling guns and bullets when the Constitution was drafted.
Indeed. So I think the step that seems most logical, and it's something that Obama did mention in one of the presidential debates, is to ban assault weapons. And that mention sadly led to a lot of people going out and buying guns in defiance of his proposal.
And briefly before we go, another big story, another sad story, unfortunately. Hurricane Sandy, Superstorm Sandy. How's the cleanup operation going? Are things returning to normal?
Somewhat. New York City is still affected. Parts Rockaway and Staten Island, a lot of New Jersey is still very affected. Over 250 people died from Hurricane Sandy as a whole across the U.S. and in Haiti. So that's probably one of the biggest stories. We'll see how the U.S. begins to address climate change over the next 4 years.
Evidence at all of Sandy still in day-to-day life in New York, walking around?
Indeed. Phone lines are still tricky. And if you're going to any part of coastal New York, in the Rockaways and Queens, in Staten Island, you're going to see places where there are still no buildings and people have no homes. There are people displaced, and they will be for Christmas and New Year.
All right. Are you spending Christmas in New York?
I will be having Christmas here in London.
Oh, very festive place to spend Christmas. It might be a white one at this rate. It's so cold. Thank you very much indeed, Aisha Spears, our New York bureau chief. That, I'm afraid, is all we have time for today. Thanks to our producer, Alan John, our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager, Sam Impey. Up next after the news is this week's episode of Culture with Robert Bound. He'll be chatting to Brazil's new culture minister. And in 3 hours from now at 2200 London time, Robert Bound and Tige Enright will be back for the Monocle Daily. Meanwhile, thank you very much indeed for listening.